accession number 19049, reel 1.
Malcolm Connolly, reel 1, where were you born, please?
Lucknow, India.
Which year was this?
1922.
Were you born in Lucknow because your father was Indian Army?
My father served in the 16th Lancers in India, part of the British Army, not the Indian Army.
And did you grow up in India?
I was 5 years of age when I returned to the United Kingdom.
Whereabouts did you return to?
I came back to the county of Wiltshire, a place called Perham Down, just outside of the military garrison of Tidworth.
Why did you come to Wiltshire rather than somewhere else?
Well, my father was born in Manchester and was raised in Folkestone in Kent. My mother was a woman. Her hometown was Norwich in Norfolk. Neither wanted really to stay here in this county of Wiltshire because they both wanted to return. My mother wanted to return back to her hometown. My father took one look at the dole queues, which was quite considerable between the wars, and decided that that was not a place for him. So he immediately re-enlisted for a very short period of time, which finished here in Wiltshire County. And we were rehoused here. My father got a job in the local ordnance depot, and that's where we've been ever since.
Where did you go to school?
I went to the local... I started off in Luggershall in the infant school in Luggershall. And in a very short period of time, we moved to Tidworth. And I went to the North and South Tidworth School, which was a church school, a Tidworth school.
How old were you when you finished your schooling?
14.
So that would be 36?
It would indeed.
Did you then get a job?
I did. I was fortunate enough to be trained as a carpenter by the local builder, W.C. Shorter and Son, and I was there until the outbreak of war.
And did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
I did indeed.
Under what circumstances?
I was working on a married quarters. We were rejuvenating old married quarters, and I remember the workmen who were listening to the wireless when it came across. And I can well remember some of the older men actually crying. And at that time, I couldn't understand why.
How did you feel yourself?
Don't think I could have cared less, not really.
Did you feel any sense of excitement?
No, I don't think so, no.
Did the war affect you at first?
Yes, my eldest brother, who was 4 years older than I, he immediately enlisted in the Royal Air Force. And the war was declared on September the 3rd, and I think on the 4th of September, he went to Salisbury and enlisted in the Royal Air Force, and he never came home no more, not until he'd done his primary training, and that was a matter of what, 4 or 6 months.
Were you in any bombing of England by the German Air Force?
Oh yes, indeed, yes. I left my employer, W.C. Shorter, mainly because I'd been on very short money, and there was a lot of money to be earned because of the extra development taking place in this part of the world. And I got a job working for a Birmingham firm, Hawkes and Snow of Shirley, Birmingham. And we did nothing else but going around big factories, putting up big lengths of black Raxine blinds for blackout. And I went with them to Ely in Cambridgeshire. I also went to Birmingham, and I was there when they bombed New Street and the Dunlop factory and one or two other places. And I was then sent up to Coventry, and I arrived in Coventry the day after the big blitz. So I thought, well, this wasn't for me. So I returned home, back home to Tidworth, and where I eventually joined the army.
Can you describe what you saw of the bombing and the destruction, please?
Well, most of it had taken place. I remember I was in lodgings with two very elderly men, a man and woman. And when I came home one day, the guest house wasn't there anymore. It had a bomb, and both the two elderly people had run the place were both been killed. And my belongings, the few that I had gone with it.
Whereabouts in Birmingham was that?
That was in the Shirley Road, which I believe at that time was the longest stretch of road in Staffordshire. I'm not quite sure about that. But there was several big factories in that road. Hawks and Snow was one. And it was then I decided that my company then asked me to go on up to Coventry. And as I say, Coventry wasn't there anymore when I arrived. So I just turned around and went back home.
I don't suppose you remember whereabouts in Shirley Road these lodgings were?
Oh, no. It's a long time ago.
It sounds as though it was the autumn of 1940.
It was, yes. Yeah. Because I was 17 when the war broke out. I was just over 17 years of age.
What did Coventry look like when you got there?
Oh dear. It's a long, long time ago. It certainly didn't make me feel very brave. And I was only there because the company that I worked for very quickly arranged transport, and we were taken out of it because there was nothing we could have done there. The factory that I was supposed to help black out wasn't there anymore.
Did you actually see the centre of Coventry?
Yes, I suppose I must have done.
Was it? But you were frightened by the sight of it.
I certainly wasn't enthralled, because I had never seen anything quite like that down this part. I'd passed through London on many occasions when raids had been taking place, but certainly I'd never been mixed up with it or anywhere close to any bomb damage or things like that. My wife, who was in the city of Portsmouth, would tell you more about bombing attacks than what I can.
How did public morale stand up to the bombing?
Well, it's hard to say after all these years, but people were going about their normal business. People seemed to live with it, really. It had happened. And people were just going about their normal business. There was big gangs of people clearing up bomb damage. But to be quite truthful, my period of time to stay there was so short. I only arrived. I suppose if my company had realised what had gone on, they'd have never sent me in the first place. But I arrived, and I was virtually turned around, and I would only be an encumbrance anyway.
Did the war affect the actual work that you were doing as a carpenter?
No, not at all. Not at all. In fact, the amount of work that was required to be done had expanded because, especially down here in this part, which is a vast military area, everything had to be blacked out in double quick time. and the vast ordnance depot, we had the contract for that. We finished that, and then we went to the other depot here in Luggershaw, which was a vast clothing depot. And then I went to the motor mechanics school at Aldershot. That was my next place. We blacked that out. And then I had this short, brief period in Coventry. And then I went straight from there to Ely, where they were building, or just finished building, a large RAF hospital. And our job, Hawks and Snows of Shirley Birmingham, it was our job to supply and fix all the vast blackout blinds. And I was there, and when that came to a close, which it didn't take us very long anyway, because there was quite a few of us there to do the job. And it was then I decided I'd had enough of roaming around the countryside, and I returned home. And I said to my father about it, and he said, why not come into the ordnance depot at Tidworth? I said, well, what can they give me to do? He said, well, he said, come and have an interview. So I had this interview, and they decided at 18, which I approximately was then, that I would be of a great use driving a three-wheeled runabout, a Lister. And I can well remember the excitement, because I'd never had anything mechanical before, of driving this three-wheeled runabout around this vast ordnance depot, fetching and carrying stores to various departments. And I suppose, being young, possibly a little bit silly, I went too fast, hit the curb and broke the suspension on it. So it was an army officer, actually, who was in charge of us. And he said to me, he said, you can go with the big recovery vehicles until your Lister is repaired. So I was sent out with the big recovery vehicles, which were big Scammels and Fordsons and real big things, tank recovery units with low loaders on the back of them. And it wasn't long before the men who drove those vehicles had me driving them as well, which I thoroughly enjoyed. And one can well imagine the excitement it gave me to drive at 18, these huge vehicles. But like all good things, it came to an end, and I was told that the three-wheel Lister had been repaired, and I had to return to drive it around the depot. This was a blow to my ego. How could I possibly go from things so big to something so small? So I'd said to my father, I said, I'm joining the army. So as he was an old soldier of many long years, I left it to him to decide what I should enlist in. Well, he was an old cavalryman, a 12th Lancer, 16th Lancer, a 5th Lancer. And it was only natural that he would pick a cavalry regiment for me, which of course at that time were then armoured. And so I went off into Salisbury, to Hale Hall, Salisbury, where I had no difficulty in passing the medical. And I enlisted in the Territorial Army for the duration of the war, or the present emergency. And I was posted almost immediately to the 52nd Training Regiment at Bovington Camp, where I was trained on armoured vehicles. I was trained as a tank driver, driver mechanic class 1 AFV, which was a status above the ordinary soft vehicle drivers. And I was there when Japan declared war in December of 1941.
How were you treated at Bollington?
I quite liked it. I They worked us very hard. They fed us very well. There was a lot of things that I'd never come across. There were a lot of, if it's the right way to describe them, there were a lot of toys for me to play with, tanks, lorries, guns, all those sort of things, which at 18, 19, were a different experience altogether. No, I remember my 4 months at Bymington Camp with the greatest of pleasure. As I say, they worked us hard. They fed us well. And I quite enjoyed it.
How did the people in charge treat you?
I look back at Bymington Camp. They actually were very democratic because there were many of these Royal Armoured Corps training regiments around the countryside. And many thousands of young men were either being called to the colours through conscription or volunteering for these units. And they had a very limited time in which to change us from civilian to soldier. And I always look back at my days in Bymington Camp with pleasure. And they treated me quite... The system actually took it very easy. I don't remember anybody shouting and bawling at me. Certainly we were the discipline. We knew exactly where we should be at a certain time and what we was going to do. But then again, there was a war on. There was nobody that actually objected. We did as we were told. We was quite democratically treated. And as I say, we were well fed, and they listened. And I honestly believe that it was all done with the greatest of discretion.
So what do they have to do to change somebody from a civilian to a soldier?
Well, you arrive in a place like Bymington Camp with many, many others of young men, and there were three squads of us. There was 106 A squad, 106 B squad, and 106 C squad. 106 A squad, we were the young ones. We were young men from 18 to 20. So the disciplines and the things that we had to do was greater than what it was on the intake of 106 B squad, who went from 21 to 26. And then 106 C squad were the older men from 26 upwards. And those men who were in the last squad, 106 C squad, they didn't have to do half the things like PT and marching and all that sort of thing that us younger fellas had to do.
Now, after Bymington...
Bymington Camp, suddenly in February of 1942, we really should have been posted before that, but owing to the fact that there was excitement in the training regiment, that they had just received the new American tank, which was the Lee and the Grunt, or the Lee at the time. The Lee is the American version, the Grunt is the British version. And they extended our course so that we could gain experience driving this American tank. So in actual fact, our course was actually extended by a fortnight, 3 weeks.
What did you think to that tank?
I was then welded to that tank because that was the only tank that... the regiments that I was eventually posted to had. I was posted at the Far East, and the armoured regiments there were either without any equipment or had very outdated equipment. And eventually we were all equipped with the Lee and Grant, and that's the tank in which we fought.
What did you think to it?
I liked it. The Lee and the Grant, I lived in it completely. that was my home for over 2 years. It was not only my home, but it was also my savior. Our complete life revolved around it, and our complete safety depended on the tank and our experience that we gained.
What was it like inside to live and work in it?
It became a way of life. After we went into Burma, we would stand to at dawn first thing in the morning, and we would stand down at dusk at night. We not only lived in it, we slept in it, and we did everything a human being has to do in it. And so it became virtually our life. We either lived in it or under it. Your life depended on its armament, and there were, of course, many, many times when these tanks were destroyed and we had to leave them. But altogether, no, the General Lee in which I drove for over 2 years in the Burma War plays big parts of in my memory.
But you had to get out to go to the toilet.
No. If you were in a situation, if it was possible to get out, yes, you did. But most times, if you were in action of any sort, then you used a shell case. And one can well imagine what it was like to be inside an armored vehicle with the temperature outside at very extremes, what with the fumes of the guns, the noise of the guns, the noise of the radios in your ear, in your ears, and somebody who had dysentery. Cordite and dysentery fumes don't mix very well.
So a shell case is like a cylinder?
Yes, right, yeah. Actually, it was sawn off. We had 7.5 shell cases, which were about 18 inches long. So somebody would have got a hacksaw and cut it off so that you could actually hold it and use it. And then, of course, you tip that straight out of the visor or through the shell case, as well as its contents out through the port holes on the side.
So it's like a makeshift chamber pot.
That's right, yes. Yeah.
So you were telling me what happened after Bovington, please.
Well, we were suddenly read orders, and there was lists of names, not only from Bovington camp, but lists of names of men who had volunteered from other units for overseas service. But out of the 106 A squad, the squad I was trained in, there was four of us who were posted then to draft number RWGHK. Never forgotten it, because it was stamped on everything that we had, kit bags, sea kit bags, and all that sort of thing. And we didn't know where we was going, what was going to happen to us. We had no inclination where we might be going. All we knew is that we were due for overseas somewhere or other. And at that particular time, what with the catastrophes that were going on in Europe and in the Far East, the Japanese were overrunning Asia. So we really had no idea where we might be destined for. All we knew that we were suddenly taken, and we took all our kit and everything into the big gymnasium that was there, and we weren't allowed out. We were warned not to contact anyone of where we might think we were going, or anything like that. So then the rush started. We started to get different inoculations, FFIs. Every high-ranking officer that came through, we had an FFI, which in layman's terms, is free from infection. How they expected us to be infected by anyone or anything, I don't know, because we weren't even allowed out. We were allowed to go to the pictures. We had to sign a book that we were going to the pictures, and they would come and check on us when they knew the cinema had turned out and we were back into our billets. We got an issue of tropical kit, which was the old Woolsey topi and the as we called them, Bombay bloomers, and big baggy shirts, all of first class quality, but all very, very, very Victorian. And I can remember us all laughing and joking when we put it on, that if we ever met an enemy, they would die laughing because of the comical uniforms that we had been issued with. We had kit inspections virtually every day. Everything had to be checked and double-checked and so forth and so on. And then, of course, they said we were leaving on about a fortnight after we'd been warned for draft. They told us we were leaving on the Sunday morning and that there would be a special breakfast laid on for us. So I immediately thought, well, I didn't know where I was going. I couldn't give any secrets away because I didn't know anything. And so I crept outside the camp to a telephone box and I phoned my father, who was employed in the big Tibworth Ordnance Depot. And I managed to contact him. And I said, well, Sunday morning I'm leaving. Don't ask me where. I said, but a train leaves Wool Station at approximately 10 o'clock. And that was that. He knew. And on the Sunday morning, we had the special breakfast with the depot band playing. And the one thing I always remember about that is the tune they played was To Kiss the Boys Goodbye, which was a rage tune at that particular time. And the regiment actually gave us 1 shilling and 6 pence, old money, out of the PRI fund. Indifferent to rank or status, you receive 1 shilling and 6 pence, which is approximately, 5.5 new pennies? Our share, I suppose, of what we paid into the coffers of the PRI fund during our stay there. And on the Sunday morning, we were marched from Bobington Camp to Wool Station, carrying everything that we had, which was virtually 2 kit bags, full marching order. Everything we possessed in life we were carrying. And I think from Bobington to Wool is approximately 3 miles. And we were loaded on a train that was waiting for us in the station. And in due course, the train pulled out, and as I looked out of the window, I saw this figure, and it was my father. He was a sergeant in the Home Guard. He'd found his way down to Wool Station, and he was there to see me off. And I never saw him no more. He died while serving in the RAF. And, of course, then we made our way up through the United Kingdom. Our first stop was Bournemouth. If you could call it a stop, it wasn't very long. It gave us time because a lot of the lads had been scribbling letters and they were asking people on the platform at Bournemouth to post them, which most people did and refused to take the postage. And it was...